I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 9th of January. Why was it so cold this week in much of the United States? Does global warming have anything to do with this cold snap? Should we be anticipating more of this kind of weather? What is a polar vortex? Could it cause severe cold? We're going to be entertaining all of those questions this hour. Today in Milwaukee, for the first time, the temperature is above 20 degrees. It feels like it's 60. Our guest this hour has been doing a great deal of work on these issues, and her work, as you can imagine, is receiving a lot of attention this week. Judith Francis is our guest, research professor and graduate program in atmospheric sciences at Rutgers University. She studies Arctic climate change, sea ice, air, ocean energy transfer, satellite remote sensing, polar meteorology, and global climate change. One of the conclusions of a recent study of hers is, as the Arctic sea ice cover continues to disappear and the snow cover melts even earlier over vast regions of Eurasia and North America, it's expected that large-scale circulation patterns throughout the Northern Hemisphere will become increasingly influenced by Arctic amplification. Gradual warming of the globe may not be noticed by most, but everyone, either directly or indirectly, will be affected to some degree by changes in the frequency and intensity of extreme weather events as greenhouse gases continue to accumulate in the atmosphere. There are differing ideas about this recent cold snap, and we'll talk about those. Some are saying that the research is fairly preliminary at this point, in part because extreme Arctic sea ice loss, and there's been a lot of it the last couple of years, is a fairly recent phenomena, so scientists don't have the long data sheets they need to draw more robust conclusions about the interaction between Arctic warming and cold snaps. But Judith has done some of the groundbreaking research in this area, and we're happy to have her with us this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Francis. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And I would imagine, get your calls and comments in early, we'll have a lot of response to this because we've all been living through one heck of a cold, cold week. Professor Judith Francis, thank you so much for being with us. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Kathleen. And just one quick correction. My name is Jennifer, not Judith.
Oh, I'm sorry. Why did I write Judith?
No, I don't know, but that's all right.
I'm very sorry. I must have been thinking about Judith, who helps work on the show. Excuse me, please. We don't want to get a name wrong. Thank you so much for being with us. So just a basic question at the beginning. Why the heck was it so darn cold this week in huge portions of the United States?
Well, it's, you know, what happens this time of year, and particularly in Wisconsin, you're sort of near that refrigerator of the United States or North America. And what happens is we get these big southward dips in the jet stream, and the jet stream is really the boundary between the cold air to the north in the Arctic and the warmer air to the south. So when the jet stream dips south of your location, you are in the colder air. And it just so happened that this week, a large blob of extremely cold air from way up in the Arctic was able to plunge southward. And that's what happened. And it's not an unusual thing to see, but this was a particularly cold blob of air.
Mm-hmm. And is there something between the loss of large amount of Arctic ice and perhaps a change in the way the jet stream has been operating?
Well, this is the topic of research that we've been involved with lately, and I should mention that my closest colleague in this work is at the University of Wisconsin, Dr. Steve Vavris. And so he's right there in your backyard. And what we've been studying and our hypothesis is that as we lose ice in the Arctic, as the Arctic warms much faster than the rest of the Northern Hemisphere, in fact, it's warming 2 to 3 times faster, the difference in temperature between the Arctic and the areas farther south is getting smaller. The reason that's important is because it's that temperature difference that fundamentally drives the jet stream in the first place, the jet stream being this very fast-moving river of air high up over our heads, up where the jets fly, that is really what controls the weather that we experience in mid-latitudes. It determines whether it's hot or cold or stormy or dry. And so where you are relative to waves in the jet stream, these north-south undulations in the jet stream, determines what your weather is. And so, as I mentioned, this very cold snap that we've been having in the middle of the country is because we've had one of these big southward dips in the jet stream. So as the Arctic warms very rapidly, and as I said, that's decreasing this difference in temperature between the Arctic and areas farther south, that means that the west-to-east winds in the jet stream are weakening because that driving force behind them is getting weaker. And we know that when the jet stream winds weaken, it tends to meander north and south more. And so we tend to see these big swings like we've seen this week, way far south over the middle of our country, but also way far north in Alaska and far north in Europe. So it's not just a phenomenon that we're experiencing here in the United States. It's actually a much bigger picture and a much bigger story of extreme events in other places, but not cold there. Alaska's been having very warm conditions for much of the winter, as has Scandinavia. And again, it's related to the fact that the jet stream is in a very wavy configuration right now.
Mm-hmm. And yet, how do you explain? I think one of the things that made so many people ask the question, what happened to global warming, is that at least in this state and in much of the Midwest and the country, our winters for the last few years have been extraordinarily mild. Everybody says, where's winter? Where's winter? Global warming must be affecting our winters, and to get a cold streak like this makes you wonder if global warming could indeed have anything to do with this, because isn't it supposed to have the opposite effect?
Right. Well, it comes back to this idea that we're seeing the jet stream take this wavier path lately. We have evidence that it's been happening in the last couple of decades. We're seeing the tendency for these patterns to increase. And as we continue to warm the globe with our emissions of carbon dioxide, and the Arctic continues to lose ice and continues to warm faster than the rest of the Northern Hemisphere, then the idea is that these kinds of sort of erratic extremes in temperature and precipitation will probably become more normal. And as I just mentioned, you know, we do have the cold temperatures here this year, but back in 2012, we had one of the warmest winters on record, and that's because these waves in the jet stream, even though it was very wavy like it is now, those waves were just in a different location. Mm-hmm. So we were getting a different type of extreme conditions from what we're experiencing this year.
Professor Francis, how much Arctic ice have we lost?
It's really rather astounding, even to people who've been watching the Arctic for a long time. As of summer 2012, so not this past summer, but the summer before, we completely smashed the previous record. In 2012, there was, in terms of the extent of the ice or how much real estate the ice was covering at the end of the melt season, there was about half of what there was only 30 years before.
Ooh.
And if we take into account the thickness of the ice and you multiply the thickness times the extent, you get the volume. The volume last in 2012 was about three-quarters loss that compared to 30 years ago. So it was a quarter the size, a quarter the volume of what it was only 30 years ago. So this loss is just amazing. It's happened very fast, and we know that the main culprit behind that is global warming.
So does it also indicate that because it's happening so fast, we really don't know and we haven't had enough years to do complete research, which is why there is some disagreement with what your report says? There are other scientists who, while agreeing completely that global warming is taking place, that what we should be seeing is quite the opposite, fewer cold snaps. Is the problem that we haven't had enough time to thoroughly examine this?
Right. Well, there's two issues that you just brought up. First of all, we are seeing many more broken high temperature records than we are seeing cold temperature
mm-hmm.
records.
Mm.
And in fact, in the United States, the ratio is about 4-1, where we're breaking four times more high temperature records than low temperature records. So that is directly connected to the general average warming of the globe. The other aspect is that we are losing this ice very fast, and this warming of the Arctic is really just starting to emerge from the natural fluctuations that happen in temperatures around the globe. So you're right that it's something that's happening to the Earth system that's relatively recent and it's relatively new, and it's only just now emerging from the noise in the system. So you're right that it's difficult to measure the impacts of that and to come up with robust statistics that either confirm or deny this hypothesis. But so far, pretty much all the evidence that that I and others are working on that are involved in this research field are finding that it seems to be holding water, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that's happening, and there hasn't been as much attention because we're all concerned about our own warmth, but what's been happening in places like Australia the last few weeks, they've been having incredible warmth, haven't they? Record high temperatures.
Yes, they have, and it's not just this year. They're seeing very large increases in temperature there, as well as drought. Argentina, too, had a very record-breaking warm pattern just recently. But again, those are, you know, 1 year at a time, doesn't make a trend. So we're keeping an eye on the southern hemisphere where things are not changing quite as quickly. But what we're seeing down there is quite different. And the jet stream is actually moving southward, so moving farther away from Australia and from Argentina. So they're, you know, they're moving more into the tropical air masses and they're getting less affected by the cold air that's down towards the south in the southern ocean.
And what happens to precipitation in the form of snow or in the form of rain when you have so much what used to be ice, now open waters?
Right. Well, the effect on precipitation is complicated, as you might imagine. But what we are seeing up in the northern high-latitude land areas is an increase in the snowfall in the early autumn. So you all are pretty familiar with lake effect snow. The same sort of thing is happening there, where because there's so much more open water, when the wind blows from that open water onto the land, it's picking up moisture off of that newly opened water and dumping it as snow on the high-latitude land areas. And that, some research by Judah Cohen at AER and MIT in Massachusetts is showing that those patterns of new snowfall is contributing to colder winters in Eurasia and Europe in particular.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. I'm sure we'll have many of them for you. Our guest this hour is Professor Jennifer Francis, and she has done some of the leading research in this whole area of whether or not global warming can result in an increase in the kind of cold snaps, severe cold snaps, that we experienced until actually just a couple hours ago here in the state of Wisconsin. She is a research professor at the Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences at Rutgers University, and she has been a professor there since 94, has taught all kinds of courses on climate change issues, also co-founded and co-directed the Rutgers Climate and Environmental Change Initiative. She also, just interestingly, this would be a fun show to have her on sometime down the road. She and her husband circumnavigated the world in a sailboat. How about that for a great dream? From 1980 to 1985, including Cape Horn and the Arctic, which is where she first became interested in Arctic weather and climate. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls for Professor and Jennifer Francis, and here's how you reach us. Again, 800-486-8655. We start with Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Well, good morning, and thank you, Kathleen, for having Jennifer Francis on your wonderful program. She was the first scientist I came across who addressed the connection between climate change and our crazy weather by focusing on this out-of-whack jet stream. I have two questions, if you have time. First, in the Midwest, you know, we've endured a scorching, record-breaking, hot, dry spring just 2 years ago, and then that was followed by this, you know, with this wildly meandering jet stream with an extremely cold, wet one, and the sort of, you know, frigid weather, or southerly wing that we're under now. And I'm wondering, you know, how will the farmers know what to plant come spring? You know, drought-resistant or heat-resistant or cold-resistant or flood-resistant crops? You know, in other words, is the most immediate concern with our warming planet going to be trying to maintain our food supply as the seasons that we count on lose their predicted seasonality?
Professor Francis, good question.
Sure is. And, you know, that's one of the big issues of the impacts of climate change that I know a lot of people are concerned about. And at this point, we don't have the ability to predict far enough ahead what kind of, you know, which way the waves are going to set up. That's what it depends on, is whether you end up on, you know, the north or the south side of the jet stream, which will determine whether you're in cooler or warmer air than normal, or whether you'll be in a stormy pattern or a dry pattern. That's just not something we can predict ahead of time. You know, once we do get one of these very amplified or wavy jet stream patterns set up, and oftentimes there's what we call a block involved, which is when one of these waves gets so large in the jet stream, it actually spins off a swirl all by itself, and this tends to lock in place the pattern of the jet stream for sometimes weeks at a time. So once that happens, then we have fairly good predictability for a couple of weeks, even a month sometimes, into the future. But at this point, it's a tough call to say, you know, what kind of a spring, what kind of a planting season that we're going to have. And I think you're very right, Carl, that the impacts on the food supply is one of the greatest concerns, I think, of climate change. Mm.
You had another question, Carl.
Yes, I did. Secondly, it's very sad and rather ironic that blazing hot records are followed by freezing cold ones, and this creates such a challenging backdrop against which the media is tasked with explaining the reality of a warming globe to those who don't follow the science. And I just was curious, you know, given the threat the path we're on poses to us all, is it time for scientists who truly understand what's going on and who know the seriousness of the issues we face to step squarely into a position of activism, and simply because the stakes are so high and the time is so short?
Well, I think we're starting to see that happen more and more. Both scientists who are good communicators, I think, are starting to realize they have an obligation to get out there and explain the science in a way that the public and a non-science literate group of whatever kind, whether it's a, you know, politicians or business leaders or, you know, you name it, I think there is an obligation that we feel now to get out there and do that, which is something that's really quite new, because this problem that we're facing is going to affect not just the food supply, but all aspects of society. And the flip side of that is, I think we're finding more journalists who are getting trained in science so that they can do a better job of communicating some of these relatively, or not just relatively, but very complex issues. And like you say, it's not easy to understand how global warming in a simple concept can turn into a very cold snap, or, you know, changes in extreme weather, because that is a more complicated explanation to give. But I do think that because the conversation's changing, because we've got more studies coming out, not just the sort of thing that we're working on, but a lot of other linkages between climate change or global warming and the immediate impacts on weather and food supply, precipitation patterns, all those things, is becoming clearer. And so we're starting to understand better how these impacts are going to affect people, where, when, and what type. And so, you know, it's a tough time, but it's also an exciting time to be a scientist working on this topic.
Well, I just want to thank you both for your commitment to this issue. Kathleen Dunn's show is some of the best stuff that I've had a chance to listen to, and Professor Francis, I think you're on the cutting edge of something that's going to become more and more common knowledge, and I really appreciate your getting the word out.
Thanks, Carl.
Thank you
very
so
much.
I really appreciate that too, Carl. Thank you.
Do you feel that you are on the cutting edge, Professor Francis?
Well, we came up with an idea that was a different way to look at how the climate change and the Arctic in particular was affecting the large-scale circulation in the atmosphere. And it makes sense to people who understand weather and how the atmospheric system works. It's something that can you can explain in a way that non-scientists can understand. And so the idea has kind of gotten a lot of traction because of that. And also, I think, because people are experiencing more extreme weather. They're seeing it on TV. They're realizing that things aren't the way they used to be. Things just aren't normal. And they can look at the Arctic and with their very own eyes, and no instruments required whatsoever, can see that half of the ice is gone. I mean, the change up there is just breathtaking. Mm. And so connecting these two aspects of climate change and weather patterns that are affecting people, you know, it seems to be an idea that whose time, I guess, was ready.
Let's go next to Karen in Madison. Hi, Karen.
Hello. I'm 62 years old, and I remember when growing up in Wisconsin on Lake Michigan, I was here from about 51 to 75, and the winters were much colder. I remember walking to school when it was 33 below zero, even though it was on the lake, and we went through a whole month when there was the temperature never went above zero once. I later took a paleoclimatology class at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, in the 90s, and we were taught that there was a mini ice age across the northern hemisphere from about 56 to 72. Now, I taught myself to really love winter, and I love winter the colder it gets, and I truly believe in global warming, but I was wondering if you'd ever heard about this mini ice age and if there's any hope of return to colder winters.
Well, the first is that, yes, there is talk of these mini ice ages. What we're learning, though, is that they tend to be very regionally focused. And so while it was maybe colder than normal in your area, it was probably warmer than normal somewhere else. But these are just natural fluctuations that happen in the atmosphere and in our weather patterns. And what we're seeing now, though, is that we're warming the atmosphere in general, so we're increasing the global temperature so that it's becoming less likely that we'll have these long-term, very cold, extreme winters in you know, wherever in the northern hemisphere. This is all a statistical thing. That doesn't mean that you can't have a colder than normal winter. But what we're seeing across the United States is many more of the high temperature records are falling than low temperature records now. And this is a result of this gradual increase in temperature around the globe. So I would say that it's unlikely that we will return to a number of years in a row where the temperatures are below or way below normal and breaking a lot of cold temperatures, unless something like a big volcanic eruption happens, which is what we know in the past has caused some of these cold years all around the northern hemisphere that are because a big volcano would put a lot of dust up into the atmosphere, which would reflect a lot of the incoming solar energy. So, you know, that could happen. But if we keep putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere at the rate we're doing it, and in fact it seems to be increasing every year, there's not a lot of hope that we're going to return to a general cooling off.
Dan emails this, as we had severe cold here in the Western Hemisphere, was there a corresponding warm-up in the Eastern Hemisphere? Conversely, does a warm winter here mean a colder winter may happen in Europe? If this is so, is the general warming of the Northern Hemisphere meaning that this polar vortex is being moved around more drastically?
Well, generally, yes, when it's colder than average in one area, you can probably look not too far away and see that it's warmer than average somewhere else. And in fact, this week is a great example of that, because while we were here shivering in the eastern half of the United States, Alaska for the last several weeks has been experiencing a very warm winter. In fact, it rained for the very first time in recorded history on the north slope of Alaska, so this is right up on the Arctic coast, in December. It's never done that before. And it's been very warm up there pretty much all late fall and winter. So we're also connecting this up with the fact that California has been so dry. They're looking at, if not one, they're one of the driest years ever, if not the driest year. And that's because, again, we get back to what the jet stream's doing. The jet stream then is coming down from Alaska across California, but bringing dry air down with it. And so the storms are just not making it into California. So then it dips down over the middle of the country, and then over, if we go across the Atlantic, what we find is that the UK has been experiencing severe storm after severe storm. And this also is related to the fact there's a dip in the jet stream just west of them, which then continues on northward up over Scandinavia, where they've been also having a very warm winter there. In fact, it extends eastward over much of northern Eurasia, and they're talking about their bird populations that typically migrate southward in the winter are all hanging around, and they're even starting to sing some of their spring mating calls. So the answer is yes. When it's abnormally cold one place, it tends to be warmer somewhere else. But the general trend in terms of the whole jet stream is a migration northward, and that's happening in both hemispheres. The tropics have been expanding, and others have done research on this and shown it in multiple different analysis techniques. So this is happening, and it's a result of the warming that's happening in a global sense.
Mm-hmm. And if you want a visual image of what Professor Francis was just discussing, she has sent us an extraordinary picture of the globe that shows what's happening with all of these jet streams all over planet Earth, and it's on our Facebook page. There's a link to this picture of Earth. So just go to the Kathleen Dunn Show and you'll be able to see exactly what she's talking about. Back to phone calls. Ned in Wausau. Hi.
Hi, I'm a limnologist, which would be like a freshwater oceanographer.
Mm.
And John Magnuson, who's now an emeritus professor at the Center for Limnology, UW-Madison, is very good at documenting the history of ice cover on Lake Mendota. And the reason we like that lake so much in North America is because it's been studied and recorded since 1880 to present as far as ice cover. And the ice cover on long-term trends are very clear that it's getting less and less ice cover on the lake. The fewer number of days is ice cover from, say, December till late March, early April. And what we need is people that are willing to look at an entire data set and not cherry-pick certain data to, for example, support their particular hypothesis. But in addition to that, I'm very concerned about loss of biodiversity, and one of the most diverse ecosystems in the world are the coral reefs. And carbon dioxide from the atmosphere that hit 400 parts per million this past year has caused the formation of carbonic acid, which is CO2 plus water, and it is causing the bleaching of coral reefs, which means the killing of this very diverse ecosystem. And that is of great concern to me because the coral reefs of the oceans are similar to the tropical rainforests of the terrestrial environment. So that's of great concern to me. And finally, my last comment is they did a study of peer-reviewed journal articles on climate change during the period of 1991 through 2012, and 17,935 of the climate scientists saw a direct relationship between human activities and the effect of increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere resulting in climate change versus only 24 that said that was not the case. Well, that's an amazing agreement among climate scientists, and that's like 98 to 99%. It's hard to get scientists that are dubious about a lot of issues to agree on most anything to that extent. So I think that the days of questioning whether climate change is occurring should be put behind us, and let's move forward with ways that we can treat this, such as a tax on carbon.
Thank you so much for your call, Ned. Professor Francis.
Well, I basically agree with everything he said. I mean, there wasn't a question there, but yeah, he makes some wonderful points, and I think it's definitely worth saying again and sometimes many times that this is a settled question in the scientific community.
Mm-hmm.
We agree, we know, we understand why the Earth is warming, and the human activities, in particular burning fossil fuels, is the reason. You know, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now is 40% higher than it was in before, say, World War II, and we know that the reason it's there is because we've been burning fossil fuels so rapidly. In fact, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now is the highest it's been in at least 800,000 years. And we know that the last time that the carbon dioxide was this high, sea levels were 6 to 8 meters higher. So we're talking like 20 to 28 feet higher than they are now. And the reason they aren't as high now as they were back then is because it takes a long time for the Earth's system to come into equilibrium with this new very rapid increase in the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's like there's a big flywheel that has to get spun up, and that flywheel is the oceans. And as the caller mentioned, you know, not only is the pH or the acid concentration of the oceans increasing, but also, of course, the temperatures are, and that's also contributing to the demise of the coral reefs. So, you know, we have a lot of change already built into the system because the carbon dioxide is so high already, and it takes a long time for that carbon dioxide to leave. So even if we were able to stop emitting it today, we still have a lot of change coming our way. So we need to understand what those changes are going to be. Getting back to the issues of what farmers should plant and so forth, there's a lot of research going on now trying to understand what these extreme events are going to look like and who's going to experience, you know, what types of variability we can expect in the future.
And Professor Francis, when Ned says it's time for us now to move on and figure out what are we going to do about this, he talked about a tax on carbon. How do you answer that? What should we do about this?
Well, there's a lot of things that have been proposed, and there's no one solution to the problem. I think some method of making it more expensive to emit carbon dioxide is a good idea, whether it's a tax or a fee or some other form of doing that. I think, you know, ultimately, when money is involved, then change is able to be promoted. So, you know, that's one way. And I think we all individually have our roles to play in just trying to use less energy in our everyday lives. So there's many things that we have to do to be more conscious of putting less carbon dioxide, less greenhouse gases into the atmosphere in any way we can manage that. But the flip side is that we also have to think about getting ready for what's coming. So this is what's often called adaptation, whereas the other is called mitigation. And so adapting and preparing ourselves for sea level rise and all the other impacts of increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are things that we also have to be working towards.
Samantha on Facebook wonders, for those students who are thinking of going into environmental studies or for people a bit older, do you feel it will be more important to focus on climate change mitigation or adaptation?
I'd probably answer yes. you know, they're both very, very important, and they both have many, many dimensions to them. So, you know, the mitigation aspect is everything from policy to engineering to renewable energy sources to new ways to be efficient in homes and businesses. So there's so many aspects of that. And then the adaptation side, again, has a lot of social science built into it, a lot of political science and policy and decision making and understanding the environment itself. So, you know, there's so many great opportunities, I think, for students coming out of school these days that you know, those careers and those focus, those topics of research just weren't there before.
More phone calls momentarily. Our guest this hour is Professor Jennifer Francis, a research professor at the Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences at Rutgers University. She has been teaching courses since 1994 in satellite remote sensing, climate change issues, co-founded and co-directed the Rutgers Climate and Environmental Change Initiative. She's been... Her studies have been making a lot of news this week because of this cold snap that we've had, and she is doing extensive work studying whether or not the change in the jet stream due to the huge amount of Arctic ice that has melted can produce one of these cold snaps, and if indeed we'll see them more regularly as one of the effects of global warming. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number. Because you spent so much of the of your life doing this, and it obviously was important in what you've decided to do with your life, I really want you to spend just a little while talking about circumnavigating the world in a sailboat from 1980 to 1985. Ooh, what an adventure that must have been.
It certainly was. And of course, back in those days, we didn't have GPS and we didn't have cell phones and we didn't have, any kind of good communication tools. And it was just my husband and I on the boat. So it was, two against the world. And it was, a fantastic growing up experience, seeing the world, being exposed to Mother Nature and really having the weather control pretty much every aspect of our life. But it really was the time when I realized that building a career in something to do with weather was really what I wanted to do. In fact, before that, I had been on a path towards dental school. So,
oh, my goodness.
A little bit of a hairpin turn. But, I grew up in New England where, the weather is also pretty influential in everybody's everyday lives. And so I was always very interested in it, but when we sailed up to the Arctic towards the end of that five-year trip, it was a real eye-opener because the forecasting that we were able to get our hands on up there was pretty much of no use whatsoever. So I figured that when I went into the weather career, not knowing I was going to get into research at that point, but I thought, well, here's a part of the world where clearly there's more work to do, so I'll specialize in Arctic weather.
Mm. You made the right choice, and you wouldn't have made the choice at all if you hadn't taken that trip, probably. Do you, do you still sail?
Yes, I'm still a very avid sailor.
Are you?
And, yes. It's, we have two kids, and they're both really very good sailors, and we live near the water in Massachusetts, so I'm out there a lot in the summertime, as often as possible.
Yeah, sounds good. David is our next caller from Madison. Hello, David.
Hi, thank you for the call. Thanks for the guest. A quick question prefaced by a comment. You know, when certain people of a right-wing political bent get on an airplane that believe in science, when they send an email about closing the George Washington Bridge that believe in science, but not when it comes to this, which is it confounds me. My question is, wasn't the whole idea of discussing about the potential negative long-term effects of greenhouse gas emissions, didn't this come up in the scientific literature almost 200 years ago in Sweden or something? I don't know the genesis of this, the potential alarm, or maybe not 200, but 50 years ago, of trapping greenhouse gases with those fossil fuels being used?
Yes, this is not a new story at all. Of course, back then, and I can't remember exactly how many years ago, but it's at least 100 years ago that it was suspected, or at least the theory was that if carbon dioxide were to increase in the atmosphere or greenhouse gases, that it would warm the planet. So this has been something that we've known about for a long time, and it's a pretty basic physical principle. Yes, this is not new. The science is settled on this. We completely understand why when there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that the planet warms. And I agree with you. It seems very inconsistent that some people are very happy to put their lives up in an airplane and depend on the laws of physics to lift that wing and lift the whole plane up off the ground. But yet, when it comes to this particular topic, they are putting their heads in the sand.
David on Facebook wants to point out one of your colleagues, Colorado State Professor Elizabeth Barnes, suggests that this explanation, your explanation, oversimplifies the impacts of Arctic warming as well as the subsequent impacts on severe weather, and wants to know how you respond to that.
Right. Yes, I'm very familiar with the paper that she wrote last year that questioned the methodology that we use to find evidence for this hypothesized theory or this hypothesis that we had. And her argument basically was the way we went about our analysis was to look at a particular height contour in the atmosphere. So it's a way of measuring the temperature in the lower layers of the atmosphere. And you look at these heights of a particular layer, and it's like looking at a topographic map of a mountainous area. So if you pick one contour, you're basically following one area of constant height. And her claim was that we didn't pick the right contour. And the contour that we chose was selected to be right where the jet stream is. And so where the jet stream is where the contours, as on a topographical map, are the steepest. That's where you find the jet stream. So we picked that contour with very deliberately so that we would track the shape of the waves in the jet stream. And her contention was that we should have picked the waviest contour, and it turns out that the waviest contour is actually much farther north, not near the jet stream, and not shaped like the jet stream at all. And so I disagree with her assessment respectfully because she's a very accomplished dynamicist and I respect her work greatly, but I don't think she completely understood how we were doing the work that we were doing. And that's my
okay. That's your answer.
It's a complicated story, but that's as simple as I can make it.
Mike in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi, actually, that was a great segue into my comments. Because earlier on, Kathleen, you were when you were making your comments or your initial questions, and as we've gone through the conversation here today, is, you know, my concern here, or my comment goes to that when we listen to programs like this and when some of the naysayers are cherry-picking information, the naysayers are recognizing more so than the people that the vast majority of the scientists that are in agreement, they understand the Charlie Brown effect, which is, if you remember the Charlie Brown cartoons, the kids all talk to each other, but the adults were just a wah, 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 wah sound. And that's what I think a lot of the lay people are thinking of the scientists in their discussions, is they don't understand thermodynamics at a detailed level. They do not understand fluid dynamics at a detailed level. It's just wah, wah, wah to them. And therefore, they can't get their arms around it. They can't accept it. But in their everyday lives, they are out there observing thermodynamics. They're out there observing fluid dynamics. You know, just the simple comment, it's cooler by the lake, is a fundamental understanding that there are thermodynamics and there are fluid dynamics at work around them. They don't understand it in the science language, though. And I think if we're going to really get policy changes, which is where we need to get the lay public, we can have all the scientists agree in the world, and we will not get a policy change until the lay public is educated on what the issue is. And I think the only way we can educate the lay public is we have to stop talking about carbonic acid. We have to stop talking about, comment about the wavy contour versus the velocity contour. That's not what the public needs to hear. What the public needs to hear is how do we relate that everyday event that they feel, they recognize, they intuitively understand, and make that connection to the agreed upon principles that are happening in the global dynamic.
Yeah, you make an interesting point because it is something we talk about every day. We talk about what's going on every day, and probably since all these changes have happened, we talk more about the weather. Do we need to be simpler, but can we be simple yet complete in our discussion of this?
Right. Well, I totally agree with Mike, I believe it was.
Yes.
That these conversations have to be made understandable by anybody. And I think this goes back to what a previous caller said as well, that scientists now are realizing that this is part of our job, or at least some scientists are. I think some scientists probably really aren't good communicators, and probably they should stick to not going out there in front of the public. But it is true that we do need to keep it at a level that anybody can understand. I work very hard at that. I know others are working on this too. And I was asked a specific question about that paper, and there was really no other way to answer it. So I had to, talk about wavy contours a little bit there. But I generally, I agree, and I try very hard to not use technical jargon. And I think that's, in some ways, that's part of the reason why the public has been very interested in the kind of work we've been doing lately, because we've been able to explain this connection that is providing an explanation for the extreme weather increases that have been happening around the Northern Hemisphere.
Thanks, Mike, so much for your call. Mary in Madison, hi.
Hello. I was wondering about the role of brine or salt in distributing. Is it because of the ocean current, the salt makes it more dense, so then it goes down and captures some of the colder water in the ocean and brings it up and cools the earth?
If I understand your question, I'm not an oceanographer, but if you're talking about the salt that's rejected when sea ice forms, is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, let's make it that reference.
Okay. Well, it's true that up in the northern oceans where sea ice forms, and sea ice is basically frozen seawater, when it gets cold in the fall and that sea ice starts to form, the salt actually does get rejected out of the ice and it goes down into the water underneath the ice, which makes that water very, very dense and cold, and ultimately it sinks all the way down to the bottom, and it helps to create this large global ocean circulation that some people have called the ocean conveyor belt. So as we've warmed the Arctic, there has been some concern that this force that drives part of the large-scale ocean circulation may be weakening, but it's also a very, very slow process. So if you're thinking of the Day After Tomorrow movie, perhaps, where, the Gulf Stream shut down and Europe got cold and New York froze overnight, well, that's not going to happen because it's a very, very slow process.
Thank you, Mary, so much for the call. We are plumb out of time. You must think every now and then, I'm certainly thinking this about you, that you were born at the right time, weren't you?
Well, I liked the time I was born.
Right.
Well, I don't know if it was the right time, but
well, it is
was
for
a good time.
For the kind of work you're doing.
Certainly. Yeah, it's been very exciting, that's for sure.
Thank you so much for being with us this hour. You made everything much easier to understand than a lot of the scientific literature does on this, and we appreciate your explanation and time. Thanks,
well,
Jennifer.
You're very welcome. Anytime.
Great, thanks. We'll take you up on that. Professor Jennifer Francis, our guest, she's a professor at Rutgers University, where she has been teaching since 1994, and her research, and she's really at the forefront of this kind of research, has been looking at the melting of the Arctic ice, losing over half the Arctic ice. Isn't that incredible? And the effect that that has had on jet streams and the polar vortex and giving us very cold temperatures. So stay tuned. We'll see what develops on all of this. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour. And thanks to KP as well for on-air production Monday at 1, All Things Political with Ovik Roy, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, former advisor to the Romney campaign on healthcare issues. So that's All Things Political on Monday.